Cannabis Use Association. Good afternoon, everyone. You're listening to the sound of universal compassion. Please enjoy.
Hello and welcome to today's program. We're following the text, Mind Training Like the Rays of the Sun, which is a commentary by the Tibetan master Namgyal Pal on another text, The Seven Points of Mind Training. Basically, these texts focus on training the mind in bodhicitta, the wish to gain enlightenment for the benefit of all beings. But that mindset is very difficult to achieve, and while we try, we have to focus on those things and attitudes in our lives that will be supports for our intention. Love and compassion are two greatest supports for bodhicitta, and we are at the point of following the instructions on how to cultivate the first, love. In the Seven Points of Mind Training, this is introduced with the instruction, meditate on the great kindness of all beings. We cannot exist without the kindness of others. In fact, we cannot even imagine how kind they've been to us in so many ways. But at least we can think to repay their kindness and so develop love for them. Having love for all beings means that we wish them to have happiness, and so our practice involves giving them everything that they need to lead happy and meaningful lives and especially attain liberation. Now, this is the mind of generosity, which in its purest form is an act of love. Last week's program ended in some discussion on using one's imaginative powers to perfect the act of giving. In thinking of all beings, we remember not just those on earth we are familiar with, but all the beings in all the realms of existence, from those in the hell realms to those in the highest God realms and everyone in between. In our previous program, we were at an initial point of giving to those in the hell realms. But we have to be careful here. As we discussed in our last program, the fulfillment of the perfection of giving is not realized when every being in existence has exactly what they need. If it was that, we'd not be able to find any being that has perfected generosity. For even just on the earth, how many enlightened beings have there been since the beginning that have met the needs of every being on the planet? Not one that I can remember. And it would seem that if those who became great beings in the past couldn't do it, we certainly wouldn't have the power either. To have perfected generosity means to have the intention and the determination to give everything that we have, even our bodies, for the benefit of others. In fact, as we saw in our last program, we train in the act of generosity by imagining transforming our body into everything that beings require and giving it to them. That includes all the material resources, everything that is needed to practice the Dharma, as well as the conditions that lead to Buddhahood. Now, you may remember that in Mind Training Like the Rays of the Sun, this discussion fell under the subheading, Giving to Those Not on a Spiritual Path. It includes those in the hells, the hungry ghosts, animals, and the gods. But I guess it started with the hell beings because they're on the lowest rungs of samsara and are suffering the most. Let's just recall what the text says about transforming our bodies into everything needed for those in the hells. It reads, just as a precious wish-fulfilling jewel provides whatever we desire, such as food and clothing, so should we imagine that in giving away our bodies, they grant all wishes, manifest as food imbued with 100 flavors, clothing to the value of 1,000 gold coins, mansions with 500 floors, excellent companions who act only as an inspiration, who are associated with enjoyment, who delight in whatever objects are to be enjoyed, and who, surrounded by their possessions, are replete with everything. They are also to be imagined as being favorable factors for the accomplishment of the very highest teachings of the Great Vehicle. Similarly, since the principal external influence is a well-qualified and virtuous spiritual friend of the Great Vehicle, we should visualize our bodies as providing the basis for hearing, contemplating, and practicing the doctrine. External factors such as scriptures of Sutra and Tantra, and internal ones such as the seven jewels of an exalted being and the three precious trainings in ethics, meditative stability, and discriminating intelligence. Essentially, these generate love and compassion in individuals' mind streams, acting as a wellspring for the awakening mind. We should then imagine that through their practice of the six transcending perfections, they reach the culmination of the two accumulations, Buddhahood, where their mind streams are endowed with the eternal delight of the perfect body of truth. And that is where we got up to last time. Namkapel goes on to mention the other realms, but before we go into that, let's take a moment to think about our motivation as we usually do. And as usual, try to generate a bodhicitta motivation. That is, that you are listening in today so that you can attain enlightenment to best help all other beings in whatever way they need, but especially leading them to their enlightenment. If you don't like that or feel unable to take on such a vast undertaking, at least think of your own freedom from suffering. Thank you. After the text, Mind Training Like the Rays of the Sun, describes how to visualize giving to the hell beings, it goes on to consider the beings in all other realms. First come the hungry ghosts. It reads, "Then in the same way, think as before, that sentient beings, including the 36 types of hungry spirits residing throughout the 10 directions, also attain the immaculate delight of the body of truth by virtue of our having given away our bodies." The immaculate delight of the body of truth refers to the body of a Buddha. So what we are imagining here is transforming our body into all the causes and conditions for the hungry ghosts to attain that. I haven't had teachings on the various types of hungry ghosts, and actually this is the first time I've heard how many there are. So we'll just have to take the variety of hungry ghosts on trust. Namkapel continues, "Next we should repeat the meditation with respect to animals, whether they dwell in the oceans or are scattered across the land throughout the realms of the universe." Here, animals doesn't only mean the mammals that roam the land, the various domesticated beings we farm for meat and skins, and the more fortunate that become our companions and pets. The animal realm also includes all the fish, reptiles, birds, insects, and all the mammals, in fact, all the living creatures on Earth that are not humans, plants, and trees. I guess bacteria, viruses, and so on are included. As one Tibetan Lama told me, the way to distinguish a sentient being from a non-sentient being is if the creature can move under the force of its own form of locomotion. In other words, does it move by itself, or does it need some other agency to move it? And this may be why plants are not considered sentient beings in the Mahayana teachings. But it appears to me a tad difficult to establish a link between a thing's mode of locomotion and its having a mind of its own. I remember reading a comment by one of the Dalai Lamas that seems to sum up the Mahayana approach, certainly in Tibetan Buddhism, to plant consciousness. Rather caustically, he said something about the fools that think a radish has consciousness. In her book, Environmental Ethics in Buddhism, A Virtues Approach, Pragati Sani admits that in line with this quote, later Buddhism holds that plants do not have their own consciousnesses. They are merely chemical reactors to environmental conditions. However, the scholar Lambert Schmitzhausen addresses the question for other Buddhist schools in his book, The Problem of Sentience in Plants in Early Buddhism. Now, I've not read this book, but Pragati Sani summarizes Schmitthausen's investigation like this. Schmitthausen has also spent a considerable time investigating the question of sentiency of plants in his work, The Problem of the Sentience of Plants in Earliest Buddhism. Schmitthausen understands sentience as something that is generally possessed by a being when it is capable of perception and sensation. He finds that Vedic religion contains some evidence that plants and seeds were regarded as sentient, and that the Jains believed that everything in the universe had some level of consciousness. However, the Buddha's position appears unclear to him. Even though there is an explicit rejection of the sentience of plants in later texts, the earlier canonical texts do not either accept nor reject such sentience. Schmitthausen concludes that the matter must be decided by induction, and so he examines passages that shed light on the issue. Schmitthausen analyzes Paticca 11 from the Pratimokta Sutta, which he understands as, if a monk or nun is ruthless with regard to plants, this is an offense to be atoned. He faces some philological problems, but eventually understands Gama to mean multitude or mass, and Buddha to mean green, fresh, living plants. Pata Viyata he understands as ruthless. In the case of plants, it could mean cutting, felling, etc. The Sutta Pitaka supports this, wherein it is seen that a monk's morality includes abstention from injuring seeds and plants. And the author quotes the relevant section in Pali, which I'm not even going to attempt to pronounce. Schmidhausen then looks into the underlying reason for this abstention. The reason may be anthropocentric, in that an injury to cultivated plants might be damaging for the owner. Anthropocentric is a word meaning regarding humankind as the central or most important element of existence. She goes on, though this is mentioned in several places, he finds that in the above two cases, no such restriction is mentioned, and that some commentaries to the verses even include moss, which is uncultivated. He rules out the case of plants being protected as an abode of animals as motive, for it does not account for the prohibition to injure seeds. Further, dry plants may be the abode of insects as well, and these are never mentioned. In search for a reasonable motive, Schmidhausen examines the introductory stories to the Pratimokcha rules, given in their commentary. In one of the stories, a monk hit the arm of the child of a deity inhabiting a tree while felling it, and this is what prompted the rule. But he rejects this motive too, for as in the above case, it does not explain the non-injury to seeds. Schmidhausen looks at another story that hints that the motive may be the disapproval of people who regard trees as living. Though he finds the story is in keeping with the beliefs of the time, Schmidhausen questions it as a historian, for the story is believed to belong to a later period and really associated with early Buddhist thought. Moreover, even if the story is accepted, it only reflects the beliefs of the time and not Buddhist attitudes. At various times in the Sutta Pitaka, it is stated that leftover food should not be thrown where there are green plants or in water with living beings. In such instances, Schmidhausen sees the possibility of proving that plants are sentient by drawing a parallel between small animals and plants. But he finds that the situation becomes complicated by the fact that there is an example in the scriptures where it is said that evacuations of excrement, snot, phlegm, etc. are not to be dropped on vegetation and water. Since early Buddhists are definitely not inclined to regard water as sentient, the parallel between plants and small animals can also be ruled out by the same extension. Schmidhausen founds that the commentaries to the various texts do mention the protection of plants, but points out that such protection is mostly anthropocentric. The focus is primarily on plants that human beings use and water meant for human consumption. He notices that in Buddhism, decorum and hygiene are associated with ahimsa, that is, non-harm. On the basis of this mixed motivation, Schmidhausen identifies another two strands in Buddhism, one purely anthropocentric, for the sake of hygiene, and the other ahimsa-orientated, for the protection of small animals. Even though Schmidhausen acknowledges verses that include plants in the category of animate beings, he warns that such passages are very few and matter of fact, and there is no passage expressly stating that plants are living. But then, at the same time, he also acknowledges that there is no definite denial of their sentience either. Schmidhausen considers the various questions that may be faced in this debate. First, if the view of early Buddhism is taken as supportive of plant sentience, why and how did later Buddhism come to adopt an opposite stance? Second, was the sentience of plants adopted simply from beliefs that existed in society at the time? Third, if Buddhists believe plants to be non-sentient, why did they not explicitly say so? In answer to these questions, he sees several possibilities. It could be that canonical passages discussing plants merely expressed the view of their commentators or other non-Buddhists rather than reflections on Buddhist beliefs at large. Well, then again, it could be that plants were seen as a borderline case, included and excluded from sentience as and when required. In terms of willful and careless destruction, plants could be included as sentient, but sentience could not be extended to vegetation needed for food due to pragmatic compulsions. Schmidthausen admits to being unable to prove conclusively that plants are sentient. However, he recognizes a general theme of respecting plant life in Buddhist texts. Seeds and plants are not to be injured. Meditation is to be done in natural and aesthetically appealing areas, and trees are often venerated and so on. As an ecological requirement, this appears to have some force. Now, I guess in a general sense, we can therefore say that plants are not sentient. But as I've pointed out before, if we take a universal view, we cannot separate sentient and non-sentient beings. A carrot may not be sentient, but when I eat it, it becomes part of the sentient being that is me. At what point does it stop being non-sentient carrot and become sentient me? And at what point will this body I call mine become non-sentient in the process of death? That is difficult to say, seeing as we are all part of one great beginningless and endless process, and nothing exists independently. From such a point of view, it is ridiculous to argue about sentient beings and non-sentient beings, for one is morphing into the other all the time. Therefore, in our consideration of generosity, why should we not consider all existence, whether sentient or not, according to our conventional point of view? This, of course, is not the traditional view, nor Namkar Pel's, and in our discussion of his text, we'd better put my somewhat heretical take to one side. Therefore, let's look at the next section in which he talks about generosity to humans. He writes, "Then we should think likewise of giving our bodies to all human beings in realms throughout the 10 directions of the universe, those living on the 4 main and 8 subcontinents, those born with freedom of movement, and those without such freedom, as well as those who lack the opportunity to accomplish the path to liberation in their present lifetime. Then, in giving our bodies to those people who do not have the opportunity to achieve the path of liberation in this lifetime, we should imagine that, through fulfilling all the external and internal factors for accomplishing the path of liberation, they gain the same result as described above." In speaking of the humans, Namkar Pel, of course, places them in the Buddhist cosmology of his time. That means that the universe consists of the huge Mount Meru, surrounded on all 4 sides by continents. Between the continents are subcontinents, and human beings of various sorts live on these continents and subcontinents. So imagining all these humans, those who can move and those who can't, we transform our body into everything they need, especially all that is necessary to become liberated. But if beings do not have the karma or capacity to become liberated in this life, we transform our bodies into all the circumstances and materials they need to get to the end of the path as quickly as possible. In other words, our body becomes everything beings need to emerge from samsara and into an enlightened state. Thus, those not able to reach the end of the path in this life can get whatever they need to complete the path as quickly as possible, maybe in another life. In essence, this means making sure that they have a precious human rebirth with its 8 freedoms and 10 endowments. Now, we've gone through these before in a previous program, but that was some time ago. So if you don't remember, the 8 freedoms are freedom from being born in the hells, as a hungry ghost, as an animal, or in the long life God realm. If we are born in any of the first 3, the suffering and ignorance would be too great to practice the Dharma. And if we are born in the long-lived God realm, we would have so much pleasure that it's unlikely we will even think of practicing the Dharma. Then another freedom is the freedom from being born in a place where the Buddha's teachings are unobtainable. Like in our world, for instance, a radical Muslim country or a place like North Korea. Of course, if the teachings are unavailable, there's very little chance we would be able to follow them and attain liberation. Then the sixth freedom is that of being born with wrong views. This means that we wouldn't believe in the law of cause and effect and karma and have no understanding of past and future lives and so forth. Then we would also have the freedom from being born where no Buddha has appeared, which would mean the complete teachings would not have been given and we'd find it very difficult to practice the whole path to liberation. And then the last freedom is the freedom from being born with mental or physical disabilities that prevent or at least make it difficult to practice the Dharma. To take an example from one of my own classes, one family regularly brings their autistic daughter to our meditations and classes. She's a bright and interested personality, but she really does not understand any of the teachings and can't grasp how to meditate. So it's hard for her to make any progress on the Buddha's path. However, she is getting many positive imprints, so it's possible that she will be able to practice in a future life, and who knows, she may well become enlightened before me or others in the class. But now, in terms of our practice, we visualize giving our body to people like this, transformed into all the conditions and circumstances for them to be free of deficiencies that prevent Dharma practice. It is also difficult for those who are blind, deaf, or dumb to practice, as you can imagine. So those are the eight freedoms, and the ten endowments start with being born as a human, which is supposedly the best type of birth for Dharma practice. Then the next two endowments are being born where there are teachings so that we can fully practice and being born with all our senses and faculties intact. Another endowment is not having committed the five heinous crimes, which are killing one's mother, killing one's father, killing an arhat, drawing blood from a Buddha, and creating schism within the Sangha community. These five actions lead directly to a hell existence in one's next life, and if that happens, it'll be almost impossible to practice the Dharma for a very long time to come. Certainly, the karma is so heavy that it will be extremely unlikely we could become enlightened in this lifetime. Yet another endowment is having confidence in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, and being devoted to them. Then the last five endowments are 1. Being born where a Buddha has appeared, 2. The Buddha has taught, and 3. The teachings are followed and flourish, 4. There are followers who practice the path purely, and 5. There are benefactors who support the followers of the Dharma. So as part of transforming our bodies to benefit the human realm, we can visualize our body becoming the 8 freedoms and 10 endowments for all humans, giving them the best situation to practice and attain enlightenment. Now, once we've covered the hells, hungry ghosts, animals, and human realms, Namkapel tells us to focus on the transformation practice for the God realm. Similarly, we should give our bodies in their entirety to each sentient being abiding among the 6 kinds of gods of the desire realm, such as the 4 great kings, the 12 kinds of gods of the form realm, from those of the Brahma family to those of the great result, as well as those of the 4 states of the formless realm, who have not entered the path to liberation. We should imagine that these gods achieve the same goal as described before. We should also imagine giving in a like manner to beings in the intermediate state between death and birth. Now again, I haven't had teachings on the various kinds of gods, so I can't tell you what they are, but practicing the 10 virtuous actions and generosity with the development of virtue and wisdom may lead one into one of the 6 kinds of gods of the desire realm. We humans are the lowest level of the desire realm, and the gods of this realm have much more pleasure than us and live much longer. Then the gods of the form realm are basically beings with a subtle body who have attained various levels of mental absorption in meditation and live in states of bliss. The gods of the formless realm no longer have a body as we know it, and only exist in a kind of spiritual state with 4 of the 5 aggregates. That's feeling, discrimination, compositional factors, and consciousness. So also for all these beings, we can visualize transforming our body into whatever they require to attain liberation as we did with the other realms. We can also think of the intermediate state or bardo beings, those who have died in one life but are not yet born into another. They exist in a spiritual body in an in-between state known in Tibetan as the Bardo. By imagining our body as a great resource to fulfill all the wishes of these beings, from the hell beings to the formless gods over time, we can generate a great deal of love and positive potential. In his commentary, His Holiness the Dalai Lama describes the whole process like this. For the realm of the hungry ghosts, we relieve them of all their problems and suffering and give them all the realizations they need to bring them to enlightenment. Then we do this as well for the animals and for the human beings who have no situations of leisure to practice the Dharma. We transform our body into all the opportunities and teachings that they need. Then we do the same for the divine gods and the would-be divine demigods. In general, we give housing and clothing to those who need it. Namkampal now talks about giving to those who harm us. He says, having imagined creating various external necessities such as food, clothing, and shelter from our bodies, we invoke all harmful elements with the hook of the awakening mind, then sincerely giving them whatever they require. Generate a deep sense of closeness to them, thinking, you have been my mother on countless occasions over beginningless time. You have tried your utmost to help me in every possible way, saving me from misery and disaster. Remember that in addition, we owe them an immense debt, having eaten their flesh, gnawed their bones, drunk their blood, and worn their skins. We have robbed them of their possessions, tortured them physically, and taken their lives. We should recognize that we now have a responsibility to repay this debt of kindness. Now, many people will say it's too difficult to give food, clothing, shelter, and so on to those who've harmed them, never mind developing compassion for them, knowing their harmful intent or actions. How can we sincerely give them everything from the depths of our heart when we are burning with dislike for them? The text here may be a bit glib, and we have some preliminary work to do before we can truly give to our harm givers. As we've mentioned in earlier programs, first, we have to make our mind an even playing field as far as friend, enemy, and stranger are concerned. In other words, we have to discard the three categories of friend, enemy, and stranger. How to do that we'll discuss next week. For now, our time is up. Thanks for joining the program today, and I hope you'll tune in again next week. Please dedicate any positive energy from our time together today to gaining enlightenment for the sake of all beings. Thank you, and goodbye.